Hello, and welcome to episode 90 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Michelle Jawando, Vice President of Legal Progress at the Center for American Progress. Michelle, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me, Jordan.
Excellent. Glad to have you. The first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing, or what have you ever done to advance the public interest, and why?
Whoa. So I will probably give a little bit of context as to kind of my motivations, because I think my entire professional career has been in service and as a way to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
My family very much has always been connected to work at the intersection of politics and policy and social movements.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like raised and steeped in this work.
Really? What were your parents doing?
My parents, well, even before that, my great aunt was the first black woman on the island of Bermuda who was an attorney and was a part of the kind of civil rights movement on that island. My father born there. And so that was, I have very fond memories of being about 7 years old, walking in marches, looking for kind of suffrage rights for non-landowners on the very small island of Bermuda. So, so that is my kind of familial background.
Okay.
And the connection for me has always been, what do we do to kind of improve the lives for others?
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of raised in that ethos and in that philosophy. And mm-hmm. so my father kind of continuing that work when he came over to the States and working with local groups and organizations and politicians and a lawyer himself and kind of always being active in the community, him and my mother. And so that is my kind of life story. So whether it was working on the confirmation of the first Latina on the Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor.
And that was when you were working for
that
Senator
That was when
Brooke
I was
Gillibrand.
Working for Senator Gillibrand of New York. As a New Yorker, very proud to do that.
Yeah.
But just what significance it was to have her voice on the Supreme Court. Or even starting the conversation about sexual assault in the military on college campuses. When we began that conversation, that was not popular. There weren't articles every other day. We weren't talking about rape culture. This was a tough issue.
How did it become an important issue? If no one else was talking about it, why did you guys think it was something that was worth talking about?
Well, I think that's why it's so important to have diversity of voices in whatever place you are.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Gillibrand's one of the younger members in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
She's a young mom.
Mm-hmm.
And recognized that there are different circles that she traveled in than the average age of the senator being about 70, so most of them are white men.
Mm-hmm.
So there were very different conversations she would have with her circle.
Mm-hmm.
And we as an office kind of got into conversations about kind of domestic violence and sexual assault from either personal stories or colleagues or friends, networks, kind of the way sexual harassment works itself in the modern day workplace that people often don't discuss. And the senator, after kind of meeting different survivors and victims, recognizing like if she wasn't going to do it when she was in a position of power, and when me as a staffer, I had an opportunity to kind of work on those issues, very difficult, and the environment we were in, but why it was so important.
So just to touch upon, you said we mentioned the concept of diversity, and just to kind of springboard into how that's relevant to bringing up this different issue. You mentioned you were talking to a lot of constituents. Would you say that because she's a female senator, that constituents, female constituents who were members of the armed forces and had experienced these unfortunate circumstances were more comfortable approaching her than male senators? Or would you say that they did approach male senators, but her being female made her more sympathetic to these particular requests of constituents, considering senators receive hundreds and thousands of requests? Or is it option C, none of the above?
Well, I think it's probably some combination of the first two, and also just an understanding that we believe these victims because we knew them personally, right? Mm-hmm. There was a connection from hearing their stories because in them we saw our friends, our girlfriends, our colleagues, some of our guy friends who kind of have gone through these situations, mm-hmm. whether we're talking about the military or on college campuses. And it's so hard when you're kind of working on the Hill or mm-hmm. even in kind of the nonprofit space. There are so many issues that come at you.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, your personal experience and your background helps to inform your advocacy and your work.
For how you prioritize.
For how you prioritize, how you're able to give voice mm-hmm. and get others to understand the value in working on these issues. So, like, when I was here, when I then came over to the Center for American Progress and left the Hill, working on King v. Burwell, which was the Supreme Court case to basically uphold the infrastructure of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time telling stories, not because we didn't want to brag about all the wonderful good things that the ACA was going to do, but we recognized that in bringing those voices to the conversation, it humanized very difficult policy fights, and that doesn't happen enough.
So when you say we, are you referring to the Center for American Progress?
Well, I would say myself here at the center, but yes.
Or are you saying liberals more generally or Obama administration officials?
Well,
or?
I would say kind of CAP was one of kind of the leaders in that fight, and mm-hmm. me working on those issues meant a lot to me personally because, you know, I could tell the story of my brother who mm-hmm. was starting his own business and needed to get on Obamacare when he graduated college. And mm-hmm. so it was different than when I can go and brief members about mm-hmm. why we needed them to go out there and talk about the benefits of Obamacare and not be afraid of it, mm-hmm. but then also bring in the personal story. And it's the same thing when I talk about issues of criminal justice. Sure. And I talk about the intersections of the way race plays into kind of the hysteria and mass incarceration that we've had in this country. Or when I talk about the Supreme Court and I say, listen, it's been a mixed history for people of color, but we have to care about the court because there are so many other factions who have for years on end. Mm-hmm. And our voices have to also kind of emerge in those fights.
So it seems like there's a theme of stories and humanizing. So Public Interest Podcast tagline is revealing our humanity.
Hmm.
So I'm very interested in this topic, and mm-hmm. our listeners are as well.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that it's important to humanize somebody, to tell a story, when you have all the data in the world mm-hmm. that already supports your mm-hmm. argument, number one? And number two, why would you even need to try to emphasize and telling this story? Why wasn't the Obama administration already naturally telling a story? Mm-hmm. Why, if they were telling a story, why weren't Americans hearing that mm-hmm. story? Mm-hmm. Why would they benefit from something and yet oppose it, mm-hmm. not quite getting the connection? Mm-hmm. So what's the importance of stories and what's the impact of humanizing a story?
So, you know, I say often Americans have a special knack for dividing one another, whether it is kind of by race, class, kind of privilege, sexual orientation. We do that quite well. It's a lot harder for us to come together.
Hmm.
And unfortunately, some of the origins of this country are baked into kind of that idea that, you know, my success is predicated on kind of your oppression. And so the reason why you tell stories and you use that in your advocacy, you use data and research to tell a broader story. And it's not always kind of the traditional way that we think about stories, but data and research can tell a meta-narrative mm-hmm. of why policymakers should be more attentive to certain needs of the communities in which they serve.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason you do that is because of connection. People by nature have to see some self-interest for themselves oftentimes for them to make the right decision. And so if you can find the connection, if I can ID kind of my connection to this work, to your lived experience, if I could see myself in you, if there are different connections that we can make mm-hmm. on a policy goal or a case or something of that nature, then I connect with you in a way that I didn't before.
So connections are important.
Connections are huge. It is part of the reason why we can work together on an issue, that we may come from very different places. We represent different interests at different organizations. Mm-hmm. But if we see the kind of the joint value in us working on something together, mm-hmm. we're both going to throw our full selves into it. Mm. And so that's really important, kind of how you bring people into your work, how you use that to erase or at least minimize some of the differences with others. You know, part of the reason we're at such a difficult moment is because we've spent the last 18 months of this election cycle with kind of IDing groups and people who were coming to take something away from you and were trying to break the type of country that you once knew. And they made people, not others, but they made people sound like there was a harm with them being a part of this broader American dream.
And we're using all these pronouns, we're referring to mm-hmm. Americans in general in reaction to the 2016 presidential election?
Correct. Okay. And when we think about the election of 2016, there was a lot of, those people are coming to take your jobs.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to build a wall to protect you. And so there, again, separation, division, otherness. And when you try to kind of break people's humanity and say, okay, so let's actually talk about what that means. And so CAP, we spent a lot of time adding the facts and then making it real for people so they understand.
Well, let's talk about some of this meta-narrative and some of these stories in a concrete way. Mm-hmm. If you care to talk about some example from your past, be it the women with the rape in the military mm-hmm. or the confirmation of Sonia Sotomayor or Elena Kagan, mm-hmm. or support of the Affordable Care Act, or something else, mm-hmm. maybe even your own narrative enfranchising women in Bermuda. Mm-hmm. And if you could just talk about how it is you construct a story, what that story really looked like concretely, what examples with mm-hmm. data and human stories really presented to make it come alive for our listeners.
Yeah, definitely. So I will give the story, I'll start with the story of the confirmation of Sonia Sotomayor, which mm-hmm. is one of the things I'm most proud of during my time on Capitol Hill.
Why are you so proud of that?
The Senate is an aggressively white space. Hmm. And at one point, I was the only black person and woman of color who was a senior counsel out of the 100 senators.
And does each senator have one senior counsel?
Each senator usually has one counsel or senior counsel or chief counsel for their work.
So you were one. So there were 99 non-females of color serving as senior counsel in the U.S. Senate.
Correct.
Okay.
One out of 100. And so, and often, when you have Supreme Court confirmations, they mm-hmm. are obviously big ticket events in Washington, D.C. Everybody mm-hmm. pays attention. You dissect background. You look at temperament. There are multi-day hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, mm-hmm. which is the Committee of Jurisdiction. And there aren't often times and history before Sonia Sotomayor, there had never been a Latina to sit on the Supreme Court.
Hmm. Had there been a Latino? And,
no.
So this is the first Latin American individual
background
to be nominated mm-hmm. for the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, it was not an accident that the first African American president for his first Supreme Court pick mm-hmm. chose kind of an esteemed jurist who was highly respected for years and years of service on the bench. Incredible. I mean, her intellect is, I mean, you have to be that type of person.
So it's important to note that he selected her based on her skills as a judge, and it was kind of icing on the cake that she happened to bring a diverse demographic background, right?
Well, yeah. I think that sometimes people kind of separate intelligence from demographic. Mm-hmm. So you can be both a person of color and very intelligent, mm-hmm. and we hope that people see that. But again, we're breaking down stereotypes, right? Mm-hmm. So until you sometimes see those people, you don't know that they exist. And so this was the first time that the world was exposed to a highly respected jurist who was a Bronx-born Puerto Rican jurist.
So just by selecting someone of her demographic in such a high-profile position, President Barack Obama broke down stereotypes about her demographic. Is that what you're trying
to say? I think... In part, I think what I'm saying is the symbolism of who she was powerful. But it was as powerful for her years of service on the bench and that she was someone that everyone said kind of in the legal community should have been on the Supreme Court at one point or another.
So how did you spin a narrative to get senators to confirm the president's nomination?
Well, as, you know, counsel working with the senator, one of the things that all the nominees to the Supreme Court do is they sit down and they meet with every member of the Senate. And they have that opportunity to ask them questions about what type of judge.
One-on-one. So about 100 meetings.
Pretty much. I mean, not everyone wants a meeting, but pretty much. You know, the candidate works with the Department of Justice and the White House to coordinate the meetings. And, you know, since we were one of the home offices, because she was a New Yorker.
And you were working for a New York senator.
I was working for a New York senator. So there was a lot of hometown pride.
Okay.
And so having the opportunity,
and
I'm from New York City. And so, you know, having the opportunity to work on that confirmation, meeting with different offices. What background information did you need? Are there particular characteristics about particular cases that you worked on that you needed more background? And just kind of making sure that we were helping to kind of bridge the gap between maybe unfamiliarity with someone that they weren't familiar with and letting people see that she was the only and the best pick for the job. And so you build a coalition of support. There were some people initially who said, of course we'll come out and support her, and some who were maybe a little bit more reluctant and probably had less to do with her, because we're unfortunately in a place now that it's less about characteristics and qualifications and it's much more personality based. And so many people who had any concerns was probably because she was a Barack Obama pick and not because of who she was.
So partisan politics played a role.
Definitely, without question. There is nothing in D.C. anymore that partisan politics doesn't play a role.
So were you trying to convince reluctant U.S. senators whom you did not work for that this was the person they should throw their weight behind?
Definitely. And I mean, obviously, the senator and the White House and, you know, members at the Department of Justice obviously were helping to shepherd, but we played a distinct role in kind of highlighting her background, highlighting her qualifications, her experience, her judicial temperament, showing years and years of her work and her qualifications. And then the zenith was the senator introducing her before the Senate Judiciary Committee and being able to share personally while she was endorsing someone of that kind, and then continuing to make phone calls. And so I will tell you, when she was finally sworn in and confirmed, it was one of the things I was most proud of, to have played a small part in in the process to get her confirmed.
So you would imagine that if Sonia Sotomayor had approximately 100 meetings or so with individual U.S. senators, then those meetings one-on-one would have given them an opportunity to really see who she was as a person, and those meetings would humanize her. But you said that there was also a role you played in humanizing her beyond that, because that wasn't enough? Or were you trying to humanize her to staff who didn't get to meet with her, or constituents who didn't get to meet with her, who were applying pressure on her senators not to support an Obama nominee? Where was the humanization? Where were you really trying to play that story?
Well, I think what we know is most important in these kind of one-on-one meetings is there's a basic threshold of qualification, and we knew she was an exemplary candidate, so that was never a concern.
Sure.
For most people, they may not be as familiar, but the courts have become another political hotbed in Washington, D.C. Who sits where?
Yeah.
And everyone thinking that kind of their nominee or pick should move the country more in their particular ideology.
Yeah.
And I think that's not how the framers intended the Constitution or the people who interpret the Constitution, which is the role of judges, to be. Mm-hmm. And so there is some degree of getting people to recognize that even if this person may have a somewhat more tilt to one side or the other.
Mm-hmm. Meaning liberal or conservative.
Liberal or conservative. But, you know, I try to shy away from those terms when I talk about judges, because I think it's been so damaging to people's ideas about the court.
How is it you define, isn't it judges are more... Scalia was more of a constructionist, is that what
strict,
it's called?
A strict constructionist, or which an originalist.
So, an originalist, right. Versus someone like Breyer, who is more interpretive.
I think some of the challenges that we find ourselves is there are some people who interpret the Constitution as the kind of the final say written as is, and they don't look at kind of case law that has been built around the Constitution to inform their decisions.
And that view is associated and that's more with conservatives and Republican nominees.
Correct, okay. Correct. And I think that there are others who see the Constitution as a kind of living document. You often hear that term, which is as you look over the course of history and the arc of history, the mm-hmm. Constitution didn't begin with the Bill of Rights, so you weren't talking about free speech and First Amendment that would give you the opportunity to talk critically about your government.
The Constitution didn't even begin with the Constitution. It came with the Articles of Confederation.
Exactly. And so what you find yourself are those who believe that, yes, there were basic principles that mm-hmm. were inscribed in the Constitution, but we should continue to look at how that affects us day to day. And that's more of a progressive or liberal leaning kind of interpretation.
So let's return to the topic of your day to day, Michelle. Mm-hmm. So you've done a lot of work in many different ways. You've worked on judicial nominations. You've worked multiple times for the U.S. Senate. You've mm-hmm. gone there, left and returned. You're an attorney. You mm-hmm. now work for the Center for American mm-hmm. Progress on legal progress issues. Mm-hmm. What is it that keeps you going? What is it that really drives you? You said you have this deep instilled sense of commitment to public service that mm-hmm. you got from multiple generations mm-hmm. in your family. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you? Why is it important? Clearly, there are other paths that people take in life. Not everyone prioritizes mm-hmm. public service. Mm-hmm. Why does it matter to you? Why is it something not only that you inherited from your parents and grandparents, but that you continually reaffirm and believe is important in your daily life?
Well, you know, I think my service is the requirement that I pay to be in this world. If more people mm-hmm. took a moment to think about how they can contribute to the lives of others, we'd mm-hmm. be in a much better state. Hmm. And we don't spend enough time thinking about that. That means you have to work on issues that oftentimes look like losing battles or, you know, caring about issues that you may take one step forward. Like in criminal justice this year, we took a step forward. Mm-hmm. But now there's a concern that we'll take a step backwards because the bipartisan coalition that we built, mm-hmm. will it fray under the new partisan, difficult climate that we're going into.
And just for our listeners, you mm-hmm. mentioned criminal justice. Was there something in particular?
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues that we've been talking a lot about are mandatory minimums that we know are one of
sentences?
The most mandatory minimums. Essentially, many years ago, around 1994, mm-hmm. We took away the ability for judges to make sentencing decisions. And we
federal
said
judges.
Federal judges. But it impacted state judges as well. Mm-hmm. And kind of state law on what ended up happening. Mm-hmm. And so what became is a system where mass incarceration in many ways is driven by these mandatory requirements to serve that takes no account into a person's background, their ability, their role in the crime that was committed, their possibility of recidivism. And so all of that were steps that we took forward because we developed over the past year or so a bipartisan coalition that said, you know what, it is time for us to reevaluate that. And so I work on that. You spend a whole year and now you're like, oh, does that coalition fall apart? But I have to believe that the work and the steps that I lay, even if I don't necessarily live to see it all, mm-hmm. But am I laying the groundwork so that that realization where we recognize that the policy, our fiscal climate, and fairness, that they all mesh, I got to keep on working towards that goal. And I can't be afraid if it's difficult or if it's hard.
And you did actually start on a topic that seemed to have very little chance of success when you were with Senator Gillibrand working on the military. What do you call it?
Sexual assault in the military and on college campuses.
And that passed.
So it a version of it passed. Obviously, not what we were looking for, but we saw many improvements around reporting and chain of command and disclosure. And we know that in some ways, some of this is culture, right? We have to learn how we interact with one another, and particularly issues around consent. And so those are fights that sometimes you don't win legislatively. Sometimes it is the culture conversation that changes, where you get more young millennial men who are engaging and saying, hey, this isn't good. It's on us to do the right thing and to join in the conversation. So that, to me, is progress, as difficult as it is. And, you know, I recognize in a very real way that, like, my life and the life that I live, I am kind of the hope of my ancestors. They could never imagine I would be advising a United States senator on policy or working on a Supreme Court nomination. That was never, that can't even have been what they imagined for themselves or for their children. And so I see it as a privilege to do this work. And I know not everyone sees it that way, but for me, it really is.
And continuing on this idea of a narrative and an acknowledgement that we're nearing the end of the podcast, and this will be a final question. We're trying through this podcast to humanize the interviewees, you. And you're speaking of this narrative and this commitment to public service. Thinking about listeners to this podcast right now, what should they know about you? What is it? What is your legacy to Americans, to humanity? What is your legacy to public service? What is it that they ought to know about you? What is it really that, what is
driver?
Is Michelle Jawando?
Who is Michelle Jawando?
They're not going to get a chance to sit with you in a room for 25 minutes.
Right.
But if they did, what would they get?
My greatest legacy will be the marriage that I have with my husband and the partnership and the children that we've created. Because I believe in those two institutions, we have the ability to do better for one another, to support one another in our goals. And in our children, we're instilling in them the value. So, like, if no one ever meets me after hearing this podcast, as amazing as the career that I have had and how awesome it has been, and I plan to do a lot more, so I'm not done by any means. I'm still hot and young. Thank you very much. But, you know, I really look at my family as my greatest legacy, because at some point I'm going to pass away. But, like, am I doing enough to pass on that? And I think about that not just with the children that I birthed, but there are a number of people around DC who are my mentees that I've, you know, poured into and believe and supporting them in their endeavors. And the reason I do that is because I've had people do that for me, and I've had people who didn't. And I recognize that you should have seeds. If you're really flowering and supporting people, then you should have little examples of where you've helped other people along the way. Because if you're the only one in the room and you're the only one with the success, then you've actually failed, because that means you didn't help anybody else along the way. So for me, I would say my family and the people around me that I try to continue to pour into.
So that has been Michelle Jawando, Vice President of Legal Progress at the Center for American Progress, who speaks about her contributions to a meta-narrative where there is a national conversation about many different issues, which she has played an enormous role on a high macro level, and that the results and consequences of her efforts will play out over time. But when she's asked what is most meaningful and impactful to her, what drives her, what gives her life fulfillment, it is the micro. It is the human impact. We speak about humanizing our interviewees on this podcast. And for Michelle, it is the very human lives that which she has had a direct impact on the love she has for her husband, for her children, the impact that she has had directly for her mentees. And it is that micro direct human interaction that defines the most important legacy for Michelle Jawando. So even having made a great contribution to America on a national level and being in the midst of a very fast rising career, being on the cusp of doing even more and greater and better and bigger things, for her, it can all start on an individual level. And for listeners, it can start with you. Very simply, with your friends, your family, and your community, you take Michelle's advice, start locally, and from there, who knows where it can grow. Michelle, thank you so much for joining
us
today. Thanks,
Jordan. This has been great. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And this has been Episode 90 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.